We've been talking about women's health all this week and why women still struggle to get the care and empathy they need across many medical conditions. Today, we turn to the realities of research and testing in medicine, which has often excluded women. Now, you might already know that recent history contains some explanations for this. Take high-profile drug disasters like thalidomide in the 1950s. That drug was given to pregnant women in dozens of countries to combat nausea. Because their mothers took the medicine, about 10,000 babies were born deformed. The scandal contributed to important federal drug regulations, but it also made researchers nervous about using women of childbearing age in their studies. And that's just one piece of the story.
We're still sort of feeling the legacy of sort of decades of research that was done mainly on men.
That's Maya Dusenberry, author of the new book called Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. She explains how this disparity came to be and the way forward.
For centuries, medicine was in some ways sort of preoccupied with women's poor health. In the 19th and 18th centuries, there was a lot of focus on women's hysteria and nervous disorders and really sort of emphasizing the differences between men and women in a way that was using those differences to sort of justify women's inferior position. And in more recent years, I think there's been a little bit of a shift to not taking account those differences at all and instead having this sort of one-size-fits-all approach that has also not been good for women because it left out the differences that we really do need to understand and really affect women's medical care.
If you could be really specific in terms of those differences, oftentimes we hear that the only difference between men and women are their reproductive capacities, but there's so much more.
Yeah, this is, you know, people have kind of referred to this as the bikini medicine approach, where medicine has sort of acknowledged differences, but only in terms of the breasts and reproductive tract. But in fact, you know, we know that women have higher prevalence rates of lots of conditions like autoimmune diseases, which affect 50 million people in the U.S. 75% of those people are women, and chronic pain conditions disproportionately affect women. We also know that when it comes to diseases that affect both men and women, there are often differences in how those diseases manifest themselves. So heart disease is a great example, if only because I think it's one of the ones that's been most researched. You know, we now, over the past couple decades, have really started going back and recognizing that after 35 years of mainly studying heart disease in men, now we should sort of look at it in women. And it turns out that there are actually differences in symptoms and risk factors. And now there's a sort of newly recognized female pattern heart disease that we previously didn't recognize at all.
One of the things that you mention in your book is that a lot of medicine is really based on a white man who weighs about 154 pounds. How does the fact that medicine is based on this white man who weighs 154 pounds translate into the development of drugs that women are using?
As recently as the early 90s, the FDA still had a policy on the books actually prohibiting all women of childbearing age from being included in early phase drug trials. And there was sort of a more general hesitancy about including women in drug research. And certainly, you know, after some advocacy in the early 90s, that's changed a bit. But there are certainly still drugs that are on the market that were studied largely in men. We now recognize that there are actually important sex differences when it comes to how lots of drugs are metabolized. And those differences arise from sort of a complicated mix of factors, you know, hormones and differences in enzymes and body fat percentage. But it's also just a difference in average body weight, right? Men are on average heavier than women. But even that sort of straightforward, simple difference is not usually accounted for. You know, there's a one-size-fits-all dosage, which means that on average, women are sort of being overdosed on a lot of drugs.
I want to make sure I understand that. You're saying that women are oftentimes being overdosed. And in your book, you write, it's perhaps not surprising that women are 50 to 75% more likely than men to have an adverse drug reaction. Is it because of these differences?
I think we're sort of just at the start of understanding these differences fully. You know, it was 2014 that the FDA announced that they were going to slash the recommended dosage of Ambien, the popular insomnia drug, in half for women. And that was after they had done studies that showed that because women metabolize the drug so much more slowly than men do, after 8 hours when they were the next morning might still be drowsy and drowsy enough to have their driving impaired and were getting into accidents. And, at that time, the director of the Office of Women's Health at NIH pointed out that, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. There are plenty of drugs besides Ambien that we just, either haven't done the research on or don't fully understand those sex differences. When it comes to preclinical research on pain using animals, it's still the case that about 80% of studies just use male animals, despite the fact that we know that there are actually some real differences. So in the early 90s, when a federal law was passed to require that NIH-funded research include women, that only applied actually to clinical research with humans. And it's, for the past 25 years, remained the case that the default when it comes to animal studies is really just male animals. And it's only in the last few years that NIH has really focused on that issue and said preclinical researchers also need to be accounting for sex and including both sexes.
So we know this is a problem. How do we move forward? How do we address this disparity and get women the medical attention that they deserve?
I think there's a growing recognition that we do have this emerging body of sex and gender-specific medical knowledge. And a lot of the problem is that a lot of that knowledge just hasn't yet been sort of systematically integrated into medical education. That's in part just because changing medical curricula is a hard, slow-moving process. But I think we are seeing more acknowledgement that that is something that needs to happen. And I've also felt sort of hopeful to hear from experts that among younger doctors and medical students today, there's more of a demand for this knowledge, a recognition that they, want to have, be equipped with the knowledge to treat their female patients as well as they can treat their male patients.
So it's one thing just to rely on the doctors themselves, but when it comes to women actually being able to advocate for themselves or to make a change in the wider community, you write that the internet has been invaluable.
Yeah. So, just in terms of giving patients the opportunity to connect with each other and kind of see that their experiences are similar, trade knowledge and advice on good doctors to go to. And I think that that kind of community online can be a way of not just helping each other get the care they need, but validating the reality of their diseases.
So my final question to you, there are so many women who are listening right now to you. What would you have them say the next time they are feeling dismissed at a hospital, at a doctor's visit?
I know my body. I know what I'm experiencing is something that is abnormal for me. You need to take it seriously or else I'm going to find somebody else. We're allowed to fire our doctors. They work for us. You don't have to stay in a relationship where you're feeling dismissed all the time.
That's going to stick with me. We're allowed to fire our doctors. You do not have to stay in a relationship where you are feeling dismissed. Maya Dusenberry, author of Doing Harm, The Truth About How Bad Medicine and Lazy Science Leave Women Dismissed, Misdiagnosed, and Sick. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been blown away by your thoughtful, personal stories about the struggle to be taken seriously and to get the necessary care.
Hi, this is Kayla from San Francisco. I'm 27 now, and I've suffered with progressively worsening hip pain since middle school. I've seen countless orthopedic doctors who all happen to be white men, and I was routinely ignored and belittled and not taken seriously. I was told to come back when I was 50 and things were really bad, and my personal favorite was when a doctor insinuated that I was being very selfish for seeking hip replacements at my age because, quote, how are you planning to have children? I just gave up at that point and started bringing my boyfriend along to the appointments just to have a man in the room to validate my experience. And shockingly, I found a doctor in October who took me seriously and was finally able to diagnose me with rheumatoid arthritis and set me up for the bilateral hip replacements that I desperately needed.
Hi, I'm in Washington State, and I am so thankful for this story. This is exactly what happened to me. And I thought I was the only one. And it's kind of frustrating to hear that it's happened to so many women. But it's also kind of validating that it isn't just me, because I was starting to feel like it was.
Janice, Newtown, Pennsylvania. I went through the same problem, not knowing exactly what was wrong with me, and then finally taking it into my own hands. Eventually, I had to ask for a complete hysterectomy due to the pain at age 42. I did have some doctors who said to me, it's a career woman's disease, and it doesn't happen to women of color, which is absolutely ridiculous.
You can hear more about facing major health issues as a woman, the argument for rethinking how we treat young women who are sick, healthcare disparities for women of color, and much more at thetakeaway.org/womenspain.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.